You're listening to another episode of the Young Investors Podcast, so sit back and relax as myself, Brandon, and my buddy Hamish discuss the latest in the world of finance and stock market investing. Now, a quick reminder before we get into the podcast is that nothing in this podcast should be taken on as personal financial advice. If you're ever unsure about your finances or investing and you need some help, make sure you reach out to a qualified financial advisor. But with all that said, let's get into another episode of the Young Investors Podcast. Hey guys, welcome back. We're back. Kinda.
You've got about 60 or 70% of me at the moment.
Okay, we've got, I reckon it's closer to 60 than 70.
Yeah,
so we do have to say, apology. We do like to get a podcast out to you guys every week. But yeah. Man, Hamish, you have had such a rotten run with illness.
Yeah,
and
I know.
I was listening to you speak last week and you were not good. I think I watched that YouTube video that you made that you forced yourself to make. Yeah. Dude, you were not good.
I know.
You could barely speak. You were just coughing.
Yeah, even now, I think you probably could tell my voice is still not quite there. But yeah, I'm pretty sure I'm cursed or something because I had COVID right at the start of the year, like right after New Year's. I then caught COVID with you guys, but it wasn't as bad because it was relatively recent after the other COVID. That was in the US when you guys all caught it. And then I caught the flu 6 weeks ago, just 6 weeks ago. And it was really bad as well. I had to go on antibiotics and everything. Like, it was a really bad one. And then now I'm actually not sure what this is, whether it's a flu or COVID. But it's been more than a week and I've been...
It doesn't matter when you just sit in your living room and don't go anywhere.
It doesn't exactly. it still feels terrible. So yeah, I apologize for last week, guys. I was absolutely... If we could have done it, I would have pushed myself to go through it. Even today, I'm kind of pushing myself to go through this. So trust me, last week I was an absolute mess. So I do apologize for that. I hate not being able to do the episodes, but yeah.
But we're gonna push through this one. Hamish is gonna push through. A lot of coughing on his end, I think. So Andrew's our editor's task might be a little bit more difficult this week, having to chop out all of the coughing. But that just is what it is. It's gonna sound like a Young Investors podcast of old, when back in the early days when I would just be like blah 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 blah, and you would just sit there and kind of be like. It'll probably sound a bit like that. I think I'll end up doing quite a bit of talking today, but that's okay. I seem to be able to do that.
Yeah, it is kind of important that we do an episode because the last couple of weeks have been kind of crazy. There's a lot that's happened.
You picked a bad time.
I know.
You picked a bad time.
I, that's the other thing. That's why I'm cursed. The stock market and finance world was absolutely dead for weeks, nothing to make content on. And then the 2 weeks where... FTX collapses, inflation numbers are coming out, the 13F filings. There's so much stuff that's happened over the past couple of weeks, even the end of earnings season. And that's when I can't make videos.
Oh, well. Is what it is. You can't control it. Whoever you are hanging out, I just think you just got to stop hanging out with anybody. Don't see anybody from now on. I mean, you're almost there. Just sitting in your living room watching YouTube all day. But I think now just block out everybody.
Now I just can't leave the house at all. Yeah.
Don't leave the house. Uber Eats for days. Yeah. Anyway, so we're going to touch on some of these stories are a little bit old, obviously, because we weren't able to do the podcast last week. So we're going to touch on the inflation stats, FTX, and then we're going to talk about 13Fs. And I want to spend a bit of time on 13Fs because that's really our forte. That's what we like to look at, the Charlie Mungers, the Warren Buffetts, the Monish Baris of the world. So with that said, let's get into it. You up for the sponsor segment?
Let's do it.
I'll do half of it.
No, no.
This episode is sponsored by ShareSite. ShareSite is an application that we've both been using over the past few years to track the performance of our stock portfolios, and it is very handy for keeping track of capital gains, dividends, dividend reinvestment plans, currency fluctuations if you're buying shares internationally or you hold foreign currencies. And of course, it's very handy because we all have to do a flip and tax return, and those things can be a pain in the butt when you have a lot of investments. But ShareSite generates up to 12 different reports that can be used to tax time to easily work out your capital gains, dividend income, and more. You can try ShareSite even for free by heading over to ShareSite.com/younginvestors, SIGHT, ShareSite, SIGHT. And if you use that link, you can get 4 months free when you sign up to a yearly subscription. There you go.
You did a great job.
Aren't I just being so nice to you today?
Yeah, you know it's bad when Brandon steps up and does the podcast, sponsored segment.
Exactly. Okay.
Where should we begin?
I'll run us through. You rest your voice. I'll run us through U.S. inflation. You can talk about U.K.
Okay.
Because we actually should have spoken about this last week we had done a podcast last week. So I don't want to dwell on inflation for too long because we talk about it so much. It's like the thing to talk about, that and the Fed and interest rate rises at the moment. But inflation in the US. So it says here, prices at the wholesale level in the United States rose 8% in October from a year ago, but that was the fourth straight decline and the latest sign that inflation pressures are easing from painfully high levels. It's so funny now. We're like 8% inflation. Oh, great.
Yeah, yeah. It stayed at 8%. Like, it's still 8% annually, but it stayed there.
Yes.
It's not accelerating.
Guys, that is... Yeah. I'm cheering. Yeah, exactly. It's pretty funny. It rewind the clock 6 months and we're like, 8%. Yeah.
You're celebrating this? Anyway,
yeah. What do you guys do? The annual figure is down from 8.4% in September. On a monthly basis, the government said Tuesday that its producer price index, which measures costs before they reach consumers, rose 0.2% in October from September, the same as in the previous month. The figures came in lower than economists expected and make it more likely that the US Federal Reserve will increase its benchmark interest rate in smaller increments. It had hiked its short-term rate by 0.75 point for 4 meetings in a row, but economists now increasingly foresee an increase of 0.5 point at its December meeting.
Mm.
I find this interesting because I remember when I heard that little tidbit from Elon Musk on the Tesla conference call, how he was saying he's seeing more deflation than inflation right now. And he kind of warned, I guess, he suggested that the Fed should be careful with their interest rate rises from this point on. I mean, it seems like Elon saw what was coming, starting to go back down.
Yeah. I mean, at least the pace of month over month inflation has certainly come off. I think there was a month where there was a 0% increase, so there was just no inflation. Mm. And then I think there's been 2.4% increases in a row or something like that, month over month. So that's a lot better than the 1%, 0.8%, 0.9% that was kind of consistently coming in earlier throughout the year. So on a month over month basis, it's definitely slowed down. I think 0.4% is like, if you annualize that, if you just have 0.4% every month for a year, I think it's about 5-6% annually. So it's still, at a fairly high rate relative to what we're used to, but certainly it's cooling down from what we saw earlier in the year. So it kind of fits with what Musk is seeing at his, at the Tesla level.
Yeah. Said most of the monthly increase reflected higher wholesale level gas prices, which rose 5.7% just in October. The cost of new cars fell 1.5% last month, which could lead to lower prices at the retail level as well. Excluding the volatile food and energy categories, core producer prices were unchanged in October from September, the lowest reading in nearly 2 years. Core prices increased 6.7% last month from a year ago, down from a 7.1% annual rate in September. So that core inflation dropping a little bit.
Interesting.
Which is interesting.
There you go.
Inflation, like, I don't want to dwell on this because, again, it's like macroeconomic predictions. Nobody knows what the hell is going to happen.
Yeah.
So it's just pointless to try and make a macro prediction.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that some of the big names in, the economy, I guess, and in business predicted, inflation's coming up and it's slowly starting to trend down now. And that seems to be what's happening. But what happens in the future? Hamish, I got no idea.
And unfortunately, I can't say that it's a similar trend in the UK. We got UK numbers this week and they're not great. Inflation in the UK surged to 11.1%, which is now a 41-year high. So, US seems to be kind of easing somewhat. Australia is still a little bit back behind both of these two places, these two regions. The UK is just full force going up.
Yeah, wow.
And it continues to be a story around their energy, which is they've been much more deeply affected in terms of their electricity and gas than even the US or Australia. And all of this actually comes despite the government introducing an energy price guarantee. So they actually fixed some prices. And despite that, the biggest contributor to inflation was still electricity, gas, and other fuels. And this is a crazy stat. Households are now paying, on average in the UK, 89% more for electricity, gas, and other fuels than last year. So that's almost a 100% increase in your electricity and gas bill, which is already a massive part of your household living expenses. It's probably the second highest expense, I would imagine, maybe close to food, other than rent or your house, your direct housing costs. So
that's insane.
That's a massive increase. And as we've spoken about, it's kind of one of those things where there's not really much you can do about it. It's not discretionary. You can kind of maybe use the heater or the air conditioner less, but for the most part, you're going to use a fairly similar amount of those resources over time, those utilities over time. So it's a difficult one for people. People have to cut in other areas ultimately.
I wonder if that stat, that 89% stat, is saying that the price for electricity and gas is 89% higher, or whether it also takes into account that right now they're in winter and so they're using more electricity and gas.
Yeah, I mean, it's from a year ago, so it's from the same...
It would be from the same comparable period.
So
it would be price.
So yeah, I think it has to be price. Yeah, I don't know exactly how they measure it, but I presume it's just that component out of the overall inflation picture. Electricity and gas has been the big driver of their inflation, which overall is only up 11%.
So in that case, they're getting like doubly screwed, because not only is the price higher, they're also now obviously going into winter.
Yes.
Well, yeah, basically in winter.
Yep.
So they've got higher prices and they have to use more of these. That's rough.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine paying, like, I don't even know what a quarterly gas or electricity bill. I guess it depends on so many factors. But like, if you're paying $400 a quarter or something for electricity, and that doubles to $800.
Yeah.
Oof. That's rough.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a squeeze.
Yeah.
I certainly feel for those over in the UK that are feeling the pinch with all this garbage going on, but hopefully we can sort it out soon.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed. But there you go. All right, that's inflation. Anything else to add?
No, not really, except that I think their interest rates are currently at 3%, but they're obviously expected to continue to go up as inflation needs to be handled some way. So
get Volker. Where's Volker? Damn it. It's not with us anymore.
Damn.
Ugh. Get him back. Bring him back. Yeah. No. Oh, gosh. Jeez, imagine that. You have a cost of living crisis and then Paul Volcker comes in and it's just like, oh, by the way, interest rates are like 15% now. Bad luck. Or 20% or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Uh-oh. Well, uh-oh. Jeez. That'll be the end.
So we hope to avoid. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. That is inflation, everybody. You want to talk about FTX?
Let's talk about FTX
while your voice is good, power through.
The first half, that's what I was thinking. In the first half of this podcast, I'm going to be able to talk. The second half, you're barely going to be able to hear me.
I'll talk about 13Fs afterwards.
No, but we should talk about FTX. I'm sure a lot of people have heard kind of stories about it. I don't want to spend a huge amount of time on FTX because there is a lot of content out there. Really, if you want the biggest kind of breakdown of the situation, CoffeeZilla's content is, in my opinion, kind of giving the most detail about all of the different things that are happening. So if you're curious about what's happening, that's a great place to dive in deep. But
I'll put Patrick Boyle's video in there as well, and also Richard Coffin from The Plain Bagel. He made a good video on it as well.
Yeah, okay. So,
but you're right. Everybody's made a video on FTX at this point.
Yeah, exactly. It's probably the biggest story, maybe the biggest. It's probably up there with inflation as the biggest story of 2022 in terms of the finance space. It's certainly the biggest. Would it be the biggest disaster we've seen this year? It's probably. I mean, we had a few disasters probably. This year. We had
probably. It's the second biggest crypto platform. Yeah that's got to be the biggest. Like, surely.
Just to give kind of a summary, and I'm going to keep it very simple. There's obviously a lot more nuances to this, but here's kind of the bones of it. So, FTX is a cryptocurrency exchange. So they essentially facilitate transactions on the blockchain, but they also offer essentially a place for people to store their crypto. So, I think the safest thing to do with crypto is you transact with it on one of these exchanges, and then you can take it out of the exchange and put it in like a cold kind of storage where it can't be hacked. For most people, it's kind of just convenient just to leave it in these exchanges. And
I'll say just quickly, if FTX were the second largest behind Binance.
Yes.
That was the second largest exchange. So a lot of people were like, oh, yeah, sure. You know, you don't expect Commonwealth or National Australia Bank to go down. They're the second biggest bank. Yeah. You know, you don't expect FTX to go down. It's the second biggest crypto trading platform. Yeah. So,
And they were being promoted everywhere. This isn't some like scammy rubbish coin. I mean, you're talking about the Miami Heat stadium was called FTX Arena, I think. The Mercedes F1 team are sponsored by them. Tom Brady had a partnership deal with him, and a bunch of people on YouTube. Although that's
Larry David. Did you see his?
Yeah.
Did you see Larry David? That's so funny.
That's great.
That's so funny. So good. For those that don't know what we're talking about, Larry David did a FTX commercial, but he's so smart. He's so smart because he would have been paid a mozza to do it.
Yeah.
But he also, his character in the commercial is the one that's like the crypto skeptic and is saying like, yeah, you know, I don't want to do anything. Yeah, I don't trust this. I don't want to do anything. And then that's how the ad ends. And then on screen after that comes up like, don't be like Larry. Join FTX today, blah, 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 that kind of thing. And it's just the funniest commercial because now it just looks like Larry is just an absolute genius.
He gets the money and he was correct.
Yeah, exactly. He's got the best of both worlds.
Yeah, there is a lot of kind of funny in hindsight videos and interviews of people who invest. Like Kevin O'Leary did one as well where he said there's, you know, he felt the safest in FTX, you know, compared to anything else in cryptocurrency or something like that. A lot of people have these videos now coming out about them glossing over how good FTX was. Such a good meme. So good. So essentially where FTX kind of got into trouble was essentially what they were doing with the crypto that they held for their users. So to understand this, FTX had a very close relationship with a crypto hedge fund, an investment fund that's called Alameda Research. And Alameda Research, this crypto hedge fund, was also founded by the founder of FTX. So the both businesses are founded by the same guy, Sam Bankman-Fried, or SBF.
It's all part of the same machine.
And they both shared the same office. So they were separate entities, but they weren't really separate entities. They were kind of both entities that he owned and that he founded. And it was all kind of entangled together. And essentially, they were supposed to be separate entities, but what we now know is that they were actually sharing client funds. So FTX funds were being used by Alameda, and they're all kind of being mixed together, and that's a big no-no, of course. In fact, I'm pretty sure that on FTX website, they said that they weren't staking any of their clients' funds. So they actually said that they weren't even, you know, the funds weren't used as collateral or any way to invest with Alameda or anything like that. But essentially, yeah, that wasn't exactly how it went down. Essentially, they were sharing client funds, and Alameda made a bunch of risky crypto bets, including a lot of what's called yield farming, which is, if you hear a description of what yield farming is, it's pretty much just a Ponzi scheme where a lot of people put money into kind of a pool and then they do some crypto lending, and essentially they use new money that comes in to pay yield for other investors, and it's literally a Ponzi scheme. And I'm sure you've
new money not affiliated with new money.
Yeah, exactly. just some insane stuff. And they were also tied up with I think it was the Celsius collapse, which happened just a month ago or a couple of months ago. So they basically were making a bunch of risky bets, and they all started to fail. And throughout this period behind the scenes, FTX, which of course, you know, was very closely aligned with Alameda, was helping Alameda kind of survive. And in total, it looks like they lent about $10 billion in total to Alameda, which is, I think, I can't remember exactly what the client deposits were in FTX, but it was basically about that. They pretty much lent everything that they had received from clients, from customers, to Alameda. And the real kicker is that in exchange for lending that money, they received FTT token as collateral. An FTT token is a cryptocurrency that FTX created. So it was FTX's own token. This is kind of confusing, but it's kind of one thing for FTX to loan out money to a hedge fund and to get some kind of illiquid collateral. So maybe let's just imagine they got property instead, right? They would still be in trouble. They might still go through a what's called a liquidity crunch, where if a lot of clients try to withdraw, they have the assets, but it's in property. So it's going to take some time for them to sell the property and get the client's money because they don't have enough cash around, right? They just have it in property. That's one thing. That's called a liquidity crunch, and businesses can come in and bail them out and give them liquidity and that sort of thing. But it's another thing when your assets have absolutely no value. And that's pretty much the case with FTX, is most of their assets were in FTT token, which was this cryptocurrency that is now down 99%. And that's essentially what happened with FTX. So over the past couple of weeks, this kind of news came out that FTT token was their big, a big part of their balance sheet, and that they might have a liquidity issue that caused customers to panic and try and withdraw from FTX, and they didn't have the money to do so, and essentially that continued to hurt the price of FTT, and they had no way that they could actually get enough cash to fund client withdrawals, and eventually they had to halt withdrawals and now file for bankruptcy. Yeah, it is kind of crazy. It's like they lent out money and then just got an IOU that is absolutely basically worthless. It's one thing to get collateral that it maybe takes a while to sell, but FTT token was actually worthless if FTX didn't survive. Mate, so
worthless. It's $1.62.
Sorry, my bad. It's worth about 1%. It's a 0.1%.
God, what a flipping crazy story.
Yeah.
Crazy, crazy story. I mean, to me, I don't know if we talk, do we talk about the influencers and the promotion, that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I think so. I think we can talk about it if you
want. Because there's no secret that FTX is just like the marketing machine. Like, and I guess that's crypto, you know, as long as there's a force behind it of people getting drawn in, it is kind of like a Ponzi scheme. You know, the more people that come in, the more everything rises, and then the more money people make, they put it into advertising, which brings in more people, makes the price rise, and it's this reinforcing thing. And FTX went crazy with the marketing. Like, they reached out to literally everyone. Like, Hamish would have an email, you would have an email in your inbox, I'd have an email in my inbox. Like, everybody was getting emails from FTX saying, oh, we want to work with you as possible. But these guys, the crazy thing about FTX and these crypto platforms is they are willing to pay big money.
Oh, yeah.
So a lot of the you know, big creators with more views than we do, they were getting like serious sums of money presented to them, being like, hey, you want to sponsor us? Yeah. And honestly, I think the money just spoke to them too much, and they started promoting this crypto platform. Anyway, now that the crypto platform's dead, all of them are, you know, oh, I'm so sorry, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Just BS, basically. But
and they were spending so much on promotions. Without naming names, there's one creator who is a lot smaller than Brandon's channel, and they were paying him, this is only for a short period of time, but they were paying him $50,000 a month, $50,000 US a month, which is like $600,000 a year for,
that's
which
crazy.
The sponsorships are good in finance, but that's astronomical for a channel that's not
stupid.
You know, in the millions of subscribers. So they were absolutely, they must have been, you know, to do these kind of campaigns, they must have been getting a lot of people to sign up. And that's really kind of the sad aspect of this, is that You know, for every $1 million that someone got to promote FTX, FTX basically stole more than $1 million of customer funds at the end of the day, because that's their business, right? So that's the sad, you know, element of it.
Yeah. The thing that always got me with FTX though, is the fact that they were promising, and just really think about this, like everybody, let's have a little think about this. They were promising on deposits. So you put money onto their platform, just depositing, they would give you 8% per year. 8%.
Mm.
Has anybody had a bank account where you can put any amount of money in there and you get 8% per year?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. When
that,
yeah, when the official cash rate's at 0.2%, I'm not buying it. Yeah. There's only one way that you could offer that. It's either that you're lying and it's a Ponzi scheme, or you're making incredibly risky bets.
Incredibly risky bets.
It would
bets.
Still be basically a Ponzi scheme.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Which is, it's just crazy. Yeah, like,
but and I think that's the thing with Sam Bankman-Fried is that. I think it was a CoffeeZilla video. Of course, it was a CoffeeZilla video. How could I forget? He was actually, he went on a podcast and he was the guy that when describing how, I think it was FTX or FTT or whatever, how it all worked, he actually literally described a Ponzi scheme.
Yes.
And then I think the host like called him out. He's like, that sounds like a Ponzi scheme. And they were basically like trying to laugh it off. Like, that sounds Ponzi. And he was just like, yeah, but you know, it fucking works.
Yeah. It was mind blowing that nobody like even questioned that was an insane thing to say. He was like, oh, well, yield farming is basically you have a box and the box has $20 million in value. And then people put money in the box and then more people put money in the box and the box has more value. It's literally like a box that does nothing. There's no economic value created. But he's describing how that's how yield farming works, which is mind blowing. I mean, it is kind of crazy that this stuff, because I mean, I heard about yield farming a long time ago, probably a couple of years ago, and it immediately to me sounded insane. Like I immediately was just wondering, how does this make any sense? This doesn't make any sense. This is impossible. I mean, some cryptocurrencies were offering, you could stake your currency and earn like a 200% annual return, which actually makes no sense. I saw this.
Yield farming is a method of earning rewards or interest by depositing your cryptocurrency into a pool with other users. The pooled funds are used to carry out smart contracts such as cryptocurrency lending that generates interest in return.
Yeah, I think it's there probably important to make a distinction that theoretically yield farming could work similarly to a bank, in that banks, you know, pool customer funds and they make investments and then they generate a return. Banks, generally speaking, these days are doing that at a very safe level. They're, you know, investing in things like government bonds and mortgages, things that are relatively stable in most normal conditions, although the GFC is kind of different. It was a bit of an outlier, but in most normal conditions, banks are making relatively safe investments. The difference with this is that there was no kind of clarity on what were the funds being pulled and what were the investments actually being made? Where was the lending actually going? And in a lot of cases, it was just lending going out to buy more cryptocurrency, and because crypto prices are going up, it can just generate more income. And it's just a Ponzi scheme on the way up. And as soon as prices collapse and no one's putting more money into the box, into the pool, then it completely falls apart. They cannot pay the old people the yield that they expect. So, yeah, it's wild, but that's cryptocurrency. It's not regulated. We've known this for a long time, unfortunately that's just the reality of it. Is like it's super risky. It's unregulated, and until it is more of a normal finance security, if it ever gets to that, that's the nature of it. And you need to be very careful. You know, only investing really what you're willing to lose. In my view, at least. So.
Yep. Well, that's the thing, is that people with, you know, money in FTX, they ever going to see that money again?
Probably not. No.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Nope. There's just not the same. This is what Richard's video on the plane bake was. There's just not that same amount of regulation, that same amount of insurance, et cetera, around cryptocurrency to make sure the consumers are protected. There's not enough consumer protection in the space like there are in other areas. So it's inherently very risky. But, yeah, I think like a lot of these big cryptocurrency kind of influencers have lost a lot of money. But, you got to do your due diligence. The thing that really pisses me off is just all the sponsorship, just pushing something. Like, I don't know. If I got something put across my desk and was like, hey, we want to sponsor you, basically what we do is, you deposit money with us and then we'll give everybody that signs up 8% per year. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Huh? How? What? Yeah. This, like, something is clearly amiss.
Yeah.
But it's just annoying how many of these influencers were just like, what, you pay me 50 grand a month? Deal.
Yeah. And
hey guys, guess what? FTX, this episode is brought to you by, it's like, shut up. Yeah. Seriously.
It is kind of crazy how many kind of promoted it. And it is, you have to do your due diligence on every promotion, of course, but there is an added layer when, like, if I'm promoting something that's a subscription fee, for example, like ShareSite, right? Like ShareSite, you pay a monthly. Mm. If ShareSite goes under, you don't lose your livelihood, right? There's an added layer when you're talking about financial products where people are investing, a big chunk or their entire life savings into a bank or into some kind of lending program or an exchange. Yeah.
A financial product.
Yes, that's exactly what you spoke about in your video, how that's why ASIC changed the rules and said that influencers have to have a financial services license if you want to have deals, affiliate deals with financial institutions, because there is that added layer of responsibility, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, it is. It's why I don't touch anything with crypto.
Yeah. The thing I think about is what's the worst that can happen? The worst thing that can happen.
Yeah.
If we're sponsored by a share site, the worst thing that can happen is, well, first of all, we both use it, but maybe necessarily it's not the right product for one of our followers, let's say. The worst thing that can happen is they sign up for a subscription, which they can cancel, and because they've found out, and they end up losing a little bit of money and not getting the best value out of whatever program we're talking about because they figure out it's just not for them.
Yeah.
That's the worst that can happen.
Yeah.
It's not we've convinced someone to sign up for FTX. They put their life savings in FTX. FTX goes under and they've literally lost their entire life savings.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's crazy.
Wild.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So I think we'll probably see some more flow and effect into other areas. We're already seeing a little bit of it. So BlockFi is another massive one that a lot of finance creators were promoting. And I think BlockFi is basically just a yield farming. So I'm pretty sure that's what it is. Maybe it's also an exchange as well, but it does a lot of yield farming. They've halted customer withdrawals and they've now acknowledged that they have significant exposure to FTX. And according to people familiar with the matter, whether or not you believe that from the Wall Street Journal, they're preparing for a likely bankruptcy. So that's BlockFi. I thought this was funny. If you Google search BlockFi at the moment, one of the top, it gives you like kind of a question box of like common questions people asked for like different search results. One of the top result is BlockFi legitimate? And this is the answer. Yes, BlockFi is legit. You can withdraw your assets at any point. Oops. And then it says, it doesn't say oops. And then it says the funds at BlockFi are held by Gemini Trust Company, which is regulated by the New York Department of Financial Services. And that's ironic because Gemini is also in trouble. So Gemini's halted withdrawals on its interest earning account. So it's yield farming accounts. It's all the same stuff.
That's so funny.
So
who's in the graveyard now? Who's in the crypto graveyard? We got Celsius, Voyager,
we got FTX,
we got FTX, we got
Alameda, and all of the associated FTX US, Alameda, FTX Global, all of those related companies.
We're about to have BlockFi,
Gemini, Gemini, and maybe Genesis is another one that's halted withdrawals.
Genesis, right? Okay.
And
that's why I said in my video, I was like, "Hey, Binance, are you nervous?"
Well, here's the crazy thing. So. At its core, FTX's problem was they were loaning out a bunch of client money and
they're doing risky.
And as collateral, they had their own token. So the value of their balance sheet was heavily dependent on their own token. Binance is in a similar situation. They have a lot of their assets in their own token as well. So
right.
I don't think they're out of the woods, and certainly it's possible that there's other smaller, I say smaller, but still big crypto exchanges, crypto.com, Coinbase, Kraken. There's like a bunch of them that are a similar size that we will see how well they've been managing client funds. But yeah, I would say if you have money in any of these exchanges, get it the hell
Run.
Out while you
get
can.
Get it out while you can.
Yeah.
If you don't act now, you are taking very large risks.
And there's literally zero reason to keep it in there at this point. There's zero reason. You're not earning anything. Like, just get it out.
If you want to keep it, just put it on a cold wallet and just put it under your mattress. Seriously.
Yeah.
Anyway. Not financial advice, but you have been warned.
No, yeah, exactly.
All right. You want to talk about 13F?
Yes. What's happened?
Let me take you through. So I'll just say I'll steal what you've already written.
Yeah,
there's a couple of people that did nothing.
Yeah.
The people that did nothing were Guy Spear and Li Lu. So there you go. I will take us through Warren Buffett, and then we'll talk about Monish Pabrai and Michael Burry as well. Warren Buffett, on paper, it didn't look like it was that revolutionary or groundbreaking. I personally thought it was very interesting. So let me run through some of the highlights, and then we'll dive into a little bit more. So the cash position from their financial statements went from $101 billion in Q2 to $105 billion in Q3. So you probably guess they didn't do anything crazy like that quarter where their cash position dropped by $40 billion. They sunk $40 billion into the market. But I always like to look at cash position because it gives you an idea of like how invested is Warren Buffett at the moment. So last quarter, he was in 25% cash. Now he's in 26% cash. And that was, of course, because the cash pile increased and also the portfolio value decreased slightly. The portfolio value is still $296 billion. I'd like to have a portfolio that size, that's for sure. And I've just made a note as well that these cash figures, they do include the $30 billion emergency fund that is for the insurance business that Buffett says that he will never, ever touch. Mm. So you can take that into account if you'd
like. How much of that portfolio do you reckon is FTT token? You reckon he's got a few stashed away?
Oh, he's probably got one or two, you know?
Imagine Berkshire comes out, we're so sorry. We actually had all of our cash in FTX.
Buffett exposed. Yeah. That's what I reckon. That's what you remember. You were saying this like last quarter. It's like, at least if you're not going to do anything, just like buy one share of some crazy stock that you would never buy just so that it gives us something to say.
And it's kind of like a shout out for that like, stock as well. Like,
it'll it's go like, up I 30%. I want Buffett to buy one FTT token.
Yeah, yeah. That would turn, maybe it just turns it around. Hilarious. And it's up. It's up 200%. Yeah,
the Buffett effect.
I mean, it'd have to go up like, what, 10,000, 100,000% or something to get back to where it was. So it's got a while to go.
Yeah, but, it would have to, many, many doublings.
Yeah.
It would have to have. Anyway, doesn't include the $30 billion of cash for the emergency fund. So if you take that out, he's got like $60 to $70 billion of cash that he could potentially splash if something really took his fancy. Although I don't know if he'd quite drain his cash pile that low, but you never know. Okay, so remember, this is Berkshire Hathaway's 13F, so that means it's Buffett, but it's also Ted and Todd. Ted and Todd have a lot less money that they manage than obviously Warren Buffett. So basically, I can't remember how many stocks. Berkshire Hathaway holds like 50-something stocks. Most of, stocks 20 and below are like Ted and Todd because they're such tiny, tiny positions. Like, they're still massive positions, but tiny compared to what Buffett's doing. Yeah. So when we look at Buffett, you gotta zoom into like the top 15 to 20 holdings. So if we look at his top 20 holdings, I'll tell you everything that changed going from the bottom up. So he reduced 5.4% in GM. He added 16% to Paramount Global. He added reduced 4% in Kroger, reduced 14% in Bank of New York Mellon, reduced 35% in US Bancorp. He bought fresh new position in Taiwan Semiconductor, which sounds boring, but I'll talk about that in a minute. He reduced 12% in Activision Blizzard. He added 22.6% to his Occidental Petroleum position, and he added 2.43% to Chevron.
Interesting.
So from that, I think there are two notable takeaways. The first one I'll talk about is this Taiwan Semiconductor. So TSM, he bought in. So this is the first time he's bought this stock in this quarter alone, and it's straight to the 10th largest position in his portfolio.
Mm.
Straight into slot number 10. So that's
pretty significant.
Up there. Yeah. So he bought 60 million ADRs worth $4.1 billion. So I'm not great on the semiconductor space, but I did do a little bit of research. So TSMC is the largest semiconductor, the world's largest semiconductor manufacturer. And very interestingly, estimates are that in 2022, they hold 56% of foundry revenue worldwide. 56%. For context, the number two is Samsung.
Yeah, wow.
And they have 16%.
Yeah, that's a classic Buffett-style investment, but near monopoly or a monopoly.
Exactly. Yeah. And I didn't really know how this all worked. So for those that don't know, so TSMC, they take on clients like Apple and Intel, Nvidia, AMD, Sony, etc., and they are the ones that actually go and manufacture whatever the hell these clients need.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how that works. And the interesting thing about right now that I was reading about is that in the past quarter or so, there's been like a complete 180 in the chip industry, which I just didn't even know about. So I was reading something that this is from the Financial Times. Qualcomm CFO Akash Palkhiwala said, quote, "It's kind of an unprecedented change over a short period of time. We went from a period of supply shortages to demand declines." And the Financial Times notes, Qualcomm has sliced 25% from its revenue guidance for the current quarter as weak consumer spending hit smartphone sales. The forecast came as some of the leading chip makers issued surprisingly weak sales and profit projections and signaled a round of job cuts ahead. Among those to take an axe to their forecasts, AMD warned that sales of processors for PCs this quarter would be down 40% from last year, with profit margins also surprisingly weak. Intel, which cut revenue forecasts again after a big reduction in the previous quarter, signaled thousands of job layoffs ahead with a plan to cut as much as $10 billion from its costs by 2025.
Mm.
So I actually didn't really know that this was happening. It's this is very sharp. Like, all we've heard about is how just chip shortage. And now it seems like we're getting to a level where rates are high enough, consumer spending is significantly restricted, that consumer electronics are not being purchased as much. And thus the chip makers are like, uh-oh. Mm-hmm. So I found that very interesting.
Yeah.
So from this information, I think my best guess is that this is like a play from Warren Buffett to take advantage of short-term uncertainty to get into an area which is obviously set for long-term growth. Like, I don't think anyone would argue that in 10 years' time that we're going to be consuming less chips than we are today. I think that industry is just going to grow. I mean, they're putting flipping chips in refrigerators and toasters now, which is just bloody stupid, but there you go.
And especially with, I don't know how this applies to what TSM does specifically, but especially with Moore's law and the rate of innovation in semiconductors really reaching a peak, at least businesses like Micron that produce memory, it's becoming less of an innovation industry and more of a commodity industry. It's kind of like people think of memory as like,
yep,
and chip making as kind of like the new internet age gold, oil. So it's kind of this needed function that's always ramping up. There's always need for more memory, more processing power, and the ability of these companies to innovate is slowing down. So it's becoming more like a commodity, and those industries are not great when there's a lot of competition, because then there's a lot of pricing wars. But in areas where there's not much competition, like you kind of just described, there's 52% market share, it's a lot easier for bigger players to kind of maintain their competitive position, maybe because of scale efficiencies or some other kind of barrier advantage.
Yep. And it's an interesting perspective as well that he's buying like the most fundamental company in the industry. Like, he's not buying, like, I know he owns Apple, but he's not buying like an AMD or an Intel or something. And I think this is actually smart because it's like he's not, another example I thought up, it's like he's not buying a pizza joint. What he's doing is he's buying the company that supplies pizza boxes because he essentially thinks that people love pizza. People are going to eat pizza. Mm. People are going to keep eating pizza in 10 years from now. Pizza joints may come and go. Yeah. Who knows what products will be good, will be bad. But every pizza needs a box. I'm going to buy the person that supplies the boxes.
Yep. And in that example, it's like it costs, you need a $10 billion machine to produce a very small amount of pizza boxes throughout a year, right? So there's this huge cost barrier that's in place because they need hugely sophisticated labs. It's quite impressive if you look up kind of how memory chips are made. I definitely couldn't give you the details, but it's like, it's not some, you know, like just manufacturing line. It's a lab. Like it's clean.
It is.
The machinery is super high tech.
And I think they have to keep the light in it. So there's like no windows. They have to keep the light at like a certain color, or a certain light, I don't know, a certain wavelength so that they can handle these, or they can process these different, you know, chips without actually damaging.
Yeah.
Or disrupting, like it's like a science. These fabs take a very long time to build. They take a lot of money to build, and you're right. It's not just like machine. It's not like a car factory where it's boom, stamp along the product, next, cut, push, weld, bolt.
No,
it really is like a science.
Yeah.
You know, laboratory.
Yeah. Transistors now that they're placing on chips are. Between 8 and 15 atoms in size. so
what?
They're literally at, and they think they can get them to 2 to 3 atoms per transistor, which is how that's even possible is actually mind blowing.
I don't know.
But that is the upper limit, and that's the idea of Moore's law, is they've literally reached the point at which they can't fit any more transistors because I don't exactly know how they work, but they need to have kind of barriers between them so they don't impact each other. So at the moment, those barriers are just a couple of atoms thin. So there's literally a point at which there's no room left. So
is that why they're digging that big circle under the chip? They're going to start colliding atoms. They're going to start splitting the atoms to make even smaller transistors.
Yeah. Well, and then you get into the
quarks
whole kind
and neutrinos
of,
or whatever.
Yeah. Well, then you get into the whole quantum computing aspect of it, and I don't understand any of that stuff. So
no, I don't. This is so
which
out
is
of
exactly
depth.
Why it's exactly why I haven't invested in the space is because I can understand Moore's law, and they can't really make the transistors much smaller, but I don't understand computing and it could very well, and I think very well, will get much more complicated. And which businesses win in that and lose, I have no idea.
Yeah, I'm with you. Like, I don't know very much. I'm just basically reiterating what I was reading online, trying to educate myself at a basic level. But I mean, clearly Buffett knows what he's talking about. So, do we have anything more to add, or move on to the next one? No. Okay. So yeah, that's really the first interesting takeaway, this buy in Taiwan Semiconductor. The second interesting thing is that Buffett just keeps buying oil stocks. His two favorites, Chevron, added 2.43%. So that's his third largest position now. It's worth $23.7 billion. It's a big, chunky position. In fact, Oxy now, he added 22.58% to Oxy. It's his sixth largest position, worth $12 billion. So that's not small. In fact, I think he owns now over 20% of Occidental Petroleum, full stop.
Wow, that's crazy.
So it's quite the position. Yeah. Does this? This is something we've talked about before. I think actually Tom was the person that spoke about this last time. Does it mean that Buffett thinks the price of oil is going up? Not necessarily. He did once say, quote, when you buy into a huge oil production company, how it works out is going to be dependent on the price of oil to a great extent. It's not going to be a geological home runs or super mistakes or anything like that. It's an investment that depends on the price of oil. So yes, obviously the price of oil is a major barometer for these stocks, but he also said in 2007, quote, if we are in an oil stock, it's because we think it offers a lot of value at this price, but it does not mean we think the price of oil is going up. If we thought the oil was going up, we could just buy oil futures, which we actually did once. So, I thought that was interesting. A lot of people, Buffett thinks oil price of oil is going up. Not necessarily. I think as boring as it is, I think he just believes that Oxy and Chevron are good, well-managed companies, and he wants to buy at fair prices. He thinks he's getting a fair price, so he's buying it. And both of these have like plans for big shareholder returns, share buybacks, dividends, etc. We know that Buffett loves a good share repurchase program to increase his ownership. I think that's just what he said. And he said like in the, what was it? I can't even remember. I didn't write it down. He said like about Vicky Holub, the CEO of Oxy. She's like, he said, you know, she's running this business exactly the way I would run it. I read through the earnings call transcript and I loved it. Every word I agreed with. So I think he just likes the businesses. Yeah. I don't know.
I think it's kind of like saying, well, is he investing in the business because he thinks that, you know, the revenue of the company will go up? And yeah, it could be, but that's only one equation. You could find a value investment where revenue won't go up. It's just like costs are going to go down, or maybe the price is really low to current earnings. So, you know,
dude, prices, that's silly. Price to sales, dude, come on. Exactly. That's the only metric you need. Yeah. I've told you this so many times.
Well,
Hamish,
that's why I'm invested in Coinbase. You know, it only has a price to sales of 742, so.
That's why I invest in FTX.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, all we can see is more users, more revenue.
Yeah.
More users, more revenue, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's it. Oh, boy.
Anyway.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Sorry, were you going to finish off that thought? Or?
No, that's it. That's all I have.
Oh, that's it. Okay, cool. Yeah, so that was Warren Buffett. They're the two big things to really talk about this time around. A lot of other small things, but honestly, unlikely it was even Buffett.
Yeah.
He did reduce a decent chunk. He reduced his Activision Blizzard stake by 12%, right. That little workout.
Yeah,
so, interesting. But nothing, not a high enough percentage to make me believe that he's changed his tune on it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe just wanted to trim it a bit because he has some nice share price appreciation that he wanted to take advantage of.
Yeah, I'd be curious to hear his thoughts on trimming, because a lot of his older interviews he talks about how he doesn't trim.
Yeah, he doesn't.
He doesn't trim. If he has conviction on a stock, he'll buy it, and if he doesn't, he'll sell it. But you know,
maybe your workout is different.
I mean, he's trimming other stocks as well. Like he trimmed Kroger and a couple other things.
That's true.
I'd love to. That'd be a question I'd have for him. Is what's his kind of thought process behind trimming? If it is in fact him that's doing it
could be accounting as well, to manage profit and loss.
Yeah.
On investments.
Yeah, like a capital gains kind of thing.
Capital gain or capital loss.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So potentially.
Yeah.
All right.
Who knows?
I'll take us through. I don't know if you have too much to say on anyone else. Anyone else?
No, I don't know.
But
not yet.
Yeah, I don't have kind of too much here. I looked at Monish's. He opened a position, which he hasn't been too active recently. So that was interesting to see. He opened a position in Brookfield Asset Management, which is now 7% of his US portfolio. So pretty significant. But just to put that in perspective, I think 92% of his US portfolio is Micron. So it's basically just just Micron, and then this kind of smaller position, and then the majority of his assets under management are in investments outside of the US that we can't see. So that just to keep it in perspective, even though it's 7%, it's probably a tiny percent of the overall picture.
You can see some of those investments if you go ticker.com. Like if you sometimes ticker.com is really good at trying to find the overseas stuff.
Yeah.
But you're right, sometimes it's very difficult. And the reporting's not as consistent. You can't stay as well informed. But anyway, sorry.
So I didn't really find too much of interest to say on Brookfield. It's an asset management company. They also have insurance operations, and then they also make investments themselves as a company. So that's kind of their three main wings. One of the more interesting aspects of the business is that they also own 62% of Oaktree Capital Management, and that is the one that Howard Marks founded and is still the chairman of that investment firm. So. Yep. That's probably the more interesting aspect, is that Howard Marks, of course, is an incredibly successful investor, and that's kind of a part of the overall asset management company. That's pretty much all I had to say. I couldn't really draw any insights into
I don't have anything to add on Monish Propri.
And then, of course, Michael Burry, he was fairly active, as he kind of always is. He likes to chop and change his portfolio a lot. He added to his Geo investment, which is the private prisons investment, I believe, and is now 38% of his US stock portfolio. And then he also initiated positions in five stocks, Securate Retail, CoreCivic, Aerojet, Charter Communications, and Liberty LILAC. So five, all kind of relatively small companies of kind of different characteristics.
He's a chopper and changer, isn't he?
Yeah, he gave a little bit of insight into some of these on his Twitter last month, where he spoke about how if a company has a lot of cash flow, but they also have a lot of debt, rising interest rates can actually be a good thing because it essentially allows them to buy back their own debt at a discount, right? So if they have bonds out and interest rates go up, the prices of those bonds go down, so they can buy them back. Similar how businesses can buy back their own stock when the stock price is low. It's kind of a cheaper opportunity for them to gain ownership in the business. So he spoke about that, and Curate Retail kind of fits the most closely out of the businesses. Although I didn't look too deeply, but Curate has a bit of cash flow and they have quite a lot of debt. So that's kind of seems to be the explanation for at least that investment. But to keep all of this in perspective, his US investments that we see on the 13F only represent $40 million of the $300 million in assets under management. So that means that he might have positions outside the US, but it also very likely might mean that he has short positions. And one of the reasons why it's likely that he does have short positions is that he tweeted yesterday, "You have no idea how short I am." So I don't know. You can't read tone on Twitter. So I don't know if that's "you have no idea how short I am" or if it's "you have no idea how short I am." I don't know if he's, you know what I mean? So
just like, "Hamish, you have no idea how short I am. Shut up."
Yeah. Like, or is you it, can't read into
Hamish,
that.
Hamish, you have no idea how short I am.
Yeah. I'm going to go with the first in that he's just saying, don't read into the 13F too deeply. You don't know what the whole picture is. I don't think it's him saying, "Guys, I'm very short." I don't think that's what it is, especially considering some of his tweets from a couple of months ago seemed to indicate that he was turning from shorting to going long. But who knows? Yeah, this tweet's another cryptic one that we'll just have to sit on.
Yeah. And there you go. That's it, isn't it? There are 13F so far. Maybe we'll talk about a few next week. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
All right. With that said, do you want to just do a couple Q&A questions and then we'll bounce?
Yeah.
Rest your voice.
Yeah, let's do it. I'm surprised I'm still going. I'm still going strong, kind of.
No, you're holding together. You're holding together. Yeah. You wanna take a breather and I'll answer this one here.
Yes. Okay. How much do you think the current share price of Tesla is tied to the personality and big plans of Elon Musk? And if the big E was to unfortunately die, how much do you think it would impact the business and its price? You don't have to worry about that because I'm not invested in them. If I was, then you should be worried that he was going to die. Because of my track record of
investments. With your track record. Oh my gosh, man. Stop killing the CEOs or the founders, for Christ's sake.
It's all my fault. So the question continues, surely the larger scale plans will eventually fade from the books with his memory and it'd become a business just like any other. How can you factor this cult personality into your margin of safety? Is it even possible?
Yeah, I don't know if it's possible, to be honest. I think to answer the first part of the question first, do you think how much of the current share price of Tesla is tied to the personality and big play? There's definitely an element of that, but there's also I don't know if there's like a certain amount of share price that is just Elon Musk. But I think to phrase it differently, if he were to die, the share price would go down by a lot. But I also think that there are other situations out there where the company's in a similar spot where they have a big notable leader, where if the notable leader were to step down or pass away or whatever, their share price would be decimated. Yeah. I actually don't know. I used to think that about Berkshire Hathaway, like, man, when Warren Buffett kicks the can, like that stock's going through the floor. I actually don't know if that will happen with Berkshire anymore because everybody is very aware that he is 90 something years old. So everybody's aware that it's going to happen at some point. Hopefully in still a fair while, but I mean, realistically, it's probably going to happen sooner rather than later. But I think for a company like Tesla, definitely maybe rewind 5 years and this used to be a much bigger issue. Like, at that point, they were mainly just a big plans company. Even if you think about, I think over the past 5 years, first of all, they have implemented a lot of those plans, and they have a very strong business that sells like some of the most in-demand cars in the world, and they have massive order backlogs, and they're building massive factories, and all that is happening. So even if Elon were to go, that would still happen. So I think the risk is definitely a lot lower than what it used to be. But yeah, I definitely think if Elon were to say step down or pass away, like probably the Tesla robot would never be exactly what Elon wanted it to be. Maybe full self-driving takes, you know, 10 more years than what he wants it to take. So I think there's an element of that. I don't think you can factor that into the margin of safety. I think that's maybe one of the reasons why you do have a margin of safety, is just, you know, in case something like this happens. So you can be half wrong and still make a good return, kind of thing.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts? What do you think? You reckon if Elon dies, the Tesla stock price just craters? I mean, do you reckon it definitely changes about their business?
I mean, it definitely craters immediately. What it does over time, I'm not sure. I think the big risk with, not just with Tesla, but with any business that's founder run, is that the people who replace them don't share the same passion for innovation. A lot of CEOs just really kind of bend the knee to kind of legacy shareholders who want to generate profit now. And that's kind of, you know, the opposite of that you get with founders is kind of one of the exciting things about businesses, is that they're willing to sacrifice profit today in the pursuit of long-term, you know, legacy and
bigger things,
produce a bigger business. And you know, sometimes that's what's necessary to make the business great. A Costco comes to mind, a ruthless aggressiveness to lower prices to smash competition.
With
a CEO who wanted to make profit immediately, or to get even just to get margins to match similar retailers on the same page, then they might not be the business they are today. So that's the question. I don't know about Tesla specifically, but that's really when there's a change of power from the founder to somebody else, it's that's kind of the question. Does it impact their competitive advantages? I'm not sure with Tesla, to be honest, but
Fair enough. All right, dude, let's wrap things up. Thanks, guys. Thanks for tuning in. Sorry that we missed the episode last week, but hopefully this one kind of makes up for it. We kind of went through all that very quickly. We had a lot to cover today. So definitely also keep sending in your questions. We definitely like your questions. We will get to them. We just had a lot to talk about, so we could only fit in one this week, but that's just the way it is. But, you know, leave a comment on the YouTube version. Leave a comment on the Spotify version as well, and we'll just keep drawing them in. Apart from that, guys, thanks very much for listening. We do appreciate it. Hopefully, Hamish will continue to recover, be on the mend. Hopefully, he doesn't catch another cold this week, and we'll be back to, you know, you'll be back to full function by next podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, hopefully.
All right. Hopefully. Fingers crossed. Yeah, we'll see. Go back to bed.
Yeah.
Drink some, have some fizzy good make feel nice, have some Barocca, and then go back to bed.
Straight back to bed. Yeah. Sounds like a plan.
All right, guys, that's it for today. Thank you very much for tuning in, and we'll see you guys next week.
See you guys.